I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. This time last week on Wednesday morning, most of us did not know that in a few hours, a mob would attack the U.S. Capitol, terrorizing the representatives and their staff, overpowering the security, and vandalizing government property. One member of the Capitol Police died after reportedly being beaten with a fire extinguisher. One of the protesters was shot and killed by law enforcement. This was shortly after a rally just blocks away where President Trump and others whipped up the crowd that included white supremacists, Proud Boys, QAnon supporters, neo-Nazis, and other extremists and would-be radicals. They had already been primed by Trump's false claims of voter fraud and by relentless calls to arms on social media. Joining us is Dr. Joan Donovan, who studies extremist groups, conspiracy theories, the radicalization process, and media manipulation. She is research director of the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, where she leads the Technology and Social Change Project. It explores how media manipulation is a means to control public conversation, derail democracy, and disrupt society. Dr. Joan Donovan, a great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. We have a lot to cover in this hour. Let me begin by asking you, can we officially rule out that it was not Antifa, it was not Black Lives Matter, it was not some radical leftist group that stormed the U.S. Capitol?
Yeah, and one of the ways that we look at how organization happens is by looking at everything posted online. And so there's, you know, a lot of open communication about what, where, and when, and how to protest. And if you look at the networks that were planning to be there and what they were saying they were going to do, this very squarely falls on Trump supporters.
I saw some tweets that even some of the people who stormed the Capitol, who were there, blamed Antifa, even though they were the ones who were doing the mayhem.
This is a constant refrain when we look at narratives of outside agitators. So this goes back even to the civil rights movement, this idea that it's not the people in our community that are doing this. This isn't us, you know, and it has a lot to do with saving the reputation of the political capacity of a movement. But in this case, the other thing that happened, and this is where we're going to dive right into disinformation very quickly,
sure,
is that at the same time this is happening, the Washington Examiner puts out an article claiming that a company used facial recognition to identify two Antifa people inside the Capitol. That company that was named in that article quickly came out and said, we didn't say that. But the damage was already done. That allegation, which we often see during breaking news events, that misinformation was planted, quickly moved around the internet and became the anchor for this bigger explanation. And so even later that night, Rep. Matt Gaetz was repeating this idea that it was Antifa somehow at the barricades. But when you look at, you know, now we have identifications, you can very plainly see that these people have social media footprints that lead back for years of Trump support and Trump posts. And so I encourage people to believe what they see when it comes to, you know, when you see massive crowds of people and the evidence is everywhere.
Well, I mean, what you're also saying is that once disinformation gets out there, gets retweeted, grows exponentially, it becomes what the truth, certainly in the minds of a number of people, or maybe even a lot of people, or perhaps even the minds of true believers.
Yeah, but it also fools the rest of us, too. That, you know, there's not a lot of ways in which we can verify things that are happening in the moment, which is why we have to be extra careful about breaking news situations, because they become fertile ground for misinformation. There's an interesting post of this older woman that's become known as the Meemaw meme. And it's just this older woman that is in the background with a bunch of other women who are in Trump gear. This was actually a picture from a different Capitol rally, not the one in D.C., where they had a permit to be inside the building and were praying inside the building as their form of protest. It was very the other one was much more peaceful. But that picture, because it got circulated in the moment of that chaos, got picked up. And people believed that this very slight woman had also moved with that crowd into the barricades. And it kind of gave an aura that the event wasn't as violent as it was. And I think in the moment when, you know, the rest of us, society is trying to do sense making, social media can really be, I love this expression from Lam Toy Vo at BuzzFeed, it can be a funhouse mirror.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting you say that. And we on Radio Times, and I'm sure a lot of other news organizations or interview programs like this, you know, struggle with how do you talk about this stuff without kind of feeding conspiracy theories? Do you play clips? We can't show pictures on the radio, but, you know, we all know what the guy in the animal suit looks like. We all know what the guy carrying the flag through the Capitol looks like, or the man who's sitting at Nancy Pelosi's desk. We can recognize these figures. How do we talk about it without becoming part of the publicity machine?
Yeah, it's hard. And, you know, the advice that we give to journalists about when you're writing about extremists, especially white supremacists, the advice is really about don't get tricked. Don't enter into creating sympathetic profiles of these people. For instance, you know, fighting against the impulse to let a group like the Proud Boys self-define. And this goes back to the descriptions of the alt-right, which should have been called at the very beginning a white supremacist group, but they were allowed to, across many different news organizations and outlets, say, you know, we're just, you know, an alternative to conservatism, you know, and they were able to, you know, insinuate in a lot of ways that they weren't who they actually are. And so when we give that advice to journalists, what we're really trying to get them to understand is that you are the opportunity that they seek in order to further spread their ideologies, and they're not going to show up as they are. When it comes to, you know, everyday people that are using their social media, they must be critical readers of journalism and go a step further into really only sharing articles that they trust or from outlets that they trust, especially at this moment where many of us are looking for people in our networks, trusted people, you know, our smart cousin to help us understand this moment. And so I just want people to understand that, like, you know, the moment is it's really important that we care about the quality of the information that we're sharing, and that when something is riling us up emotionally, that we should be suspect of it.
Let me quote you. Mm-hmm. You said or wrote, a conspiracy is a normal reaction to an extraordinary situation. But when conspiracy reaches millions and the charismatic figure at the top or at the center calls for action, it is no longer just a belief. It is a cause. Is that what we're seeing today?
Yeah, I felt a little bit like Chicken Little in the past couple of weeks. And I was like a very similar feeling before the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, because when you see it laid out so plainly and you see it everywhere and you see people buying plane tickets and organizing ride shares to go to the Capitol to be part of the siege, it's not the case that I'm going to sit back as a researcher and say, well, let me just collect my data here. I really felt that this moment was reaching a fever pitch, was reaching a flashpoint. And Brandi Collins-Dexter is a research fellow on our team that looks at social media use in Black communities, and especially conspiracy theories. And sometimes when conspiracy theories spread through a community, it's really about protecting one another. The allegations that something was wrong with the water in Flint prior to scientific confirmation, as well as every other kind of confirmation evidence that you would need to prove that it wasn't a conspiracy theory but was actually happening, that takes time. And so especially other kinds of conspiracies that she identified circulating about the pandemic and coronavirus in the Black community, we have a report of that up on mediamanipulation.org if people want to read about it. But the idea isn't that necessarily that all conspiracy is going to lead to this moment. What I'm trying to point out is that when someone takes hold, starts making calls to action, and says, you know, very plainly, we're going to have, you know, a wild protest, which then led to people, you know, registering the domain wild protest and asking for donations, et cetera. That's when it becomes a cause, right? That's when we have to look for that switch and treat it as it is, which is people really thought this was their 1776.
Yeah, and I do want to talk about President Trump, but looking at this extraordinary situation, how much do you think, though, the pandemic, the anxiety about the pandemic, the fact that it has, you know, caused great dislocation, people have lost their jobs, people are, you know, in line at food pantries, how much do you think that has driven some of the feelings and even some of the conspiracy theories that are so prevalent today?
Yeah, so I've been writing rather feverishly this week, but one of the things that I've been really thinking on is the few moments that this year that have led us up to this exact, you know, powder keg that was, you know, Trump really lit the match, which is to say that the pandemic was an opportunity for many of these groups to start meeting locally. I've written about this for MIT Tech Review, this idea that when misinformation mobilizes, we have to be cognizant of the fact that these groups are not necessarily just like, you know, we can't reduce it to human psychology. We actually have to look at the group dynamics. And the reopen protests, as well as counter demonstrations in Kenosha, for instance, against Black Lives Matter, this is a really important feature of how we end up here, because these groups slowly over time builds, move from what sociologists call weak ties, which is I met this, you know, I know this guy online, I follow him on Twitter, to stronger ties where you've met in person and you're planning something else together. And
you know,
this trajectory,
I got to only because we're almost up on a break here. That's OK. I'll be right back to you, Joan Donovan. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine. What's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We're talking about the fact that we are still coming to terms with the attack on the U.S. Capitol, driven by extremists, by conspiracy theories, and our guest is Joan Donovan. She's research director of the Shorenstein Center on Media Politics and Public Policy. That's at the Harvard Kennedy School, where she leads the Technology and Social Change Project. It explores how media manipulation is a means to control public conversation, derail democracy, and disrupt society. Joan, before I interrupt you, I interrupted you right before the break. You were talking about sort of comparing the power of, you know, online relationships that people have and in-person relationships that people have and the, I guess, the power differential between the two of them. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, well, I was just explaining essentially that the pandemic and the conditions of the pandemic really created the fertile ground on which these groups would come together and then learn how to mobilize together, learn how to protest together And but I hesitate, of course, to use this word protest because that's not what happened here.
No.
Typically, when we think about a protest, you think about a someone or a community org getting involved and saying, we need action and we need action now. But in this instance, we don't really have a great language to talk about political oppression and social media when it's the president calling for his supporters to come out and attack the government. And the only other thing I'll say about the rhetoric online, it had ratcheted up over the course of the past few weeks to the point where someone like Lynn Wood, who had been really involved in the court cases that Sidney Powell had put together and in the orbit of Rudy Giuliani, he really became unhinged and eventually was calling for civil war in the execution of Mike Pence on Twitter.
On Twitter, exactly.
On Twitter, right.
On Twitter.
Which is like, it feels crazy to say it out loud.
Well, let me ask you about the president. And, you know, we're not going to play clips from his speech last Wednesday, but I'll just quote something of what he said. And I saw that he used the word fight something like 20 or 21 times. And he was talking to his crowd. He also said, we're going to walk down to the Capitol and we're going to cheer on our brave senators and congressmen and women. We're probably not going to be cheering so much for them because you'll never take back our country with weakness. You have to show strength and you have to be strong. For people who love the president and hang on his every word, Joan Donovan, what did those words mean to them?
Yeah, I think, oh man, you know, when you think about why people protest, there's a few different reasons, getting media attention. But one of them is about recognition of people in power. And so the reason why a lot of the people had shown up to the Capitol was expressly because the president had asked them to be there. So why people gather in mass has a lot to do with that recognition. And so when he was giving that speech, a lot of people were getting really excited. They were getting, you know, the posts online. If you look at them, people were posting more. They were posting pictures, selfies. But at the same time that he's doing that, you have another contingent of people who are in town for the president, mostly led by the Proud Boys, that are already at the Capitol. They didn't even go to Trump's speech because they were waiting for 1 p.m. And everybody knew that everybody knew at 1 p.m. that's when the congressional certification process was to begin. And that was really going to be when it got set off. But early in Trump's speech, he said that statement that you read about 16 minutes into the speech. And at that point is when you start to see people peel off from listening to him and start to walk over to the Capitol in anticipation of what happens next.
I mean, you know, we're asking you to get into the minds of people you do not know, but in their mind, was the president telling them to storm the U.S. Capitol?
So we also have to think about what the word storm means here, because for most people, it means absolutely nothing, or it invokes feelings about, like, you know, Will Smith action movies, right? Like Independence Day.
Yeah.
You know, like, it has this cinematic feel. But within the QAnon faction and within this very online crowd, the storm is coming. The storm is a key word amongst QAnon folks that they have been looking to for years. There was a lot made of a very passing comment that Trump said about, this is the calm before the storm. And this happened maybe 2018 or so, but it was an inkling that he was paying attention to them. And they really believe that they are being leaked secrets by someone that is deep in the government working with Trump to arrest traitors. And so the storm for them is something really important. And so the idea that you would storm the Capitol really plays into this fantasy that a lot of them had been reading about and even posting about for years.
Here was a post, it was on the Donald.win, and this is what one of the posts said, I guess, in anticipation of last Wednesday's attack on the Capitol. Quote, "The Capitol is our goal. Everything else is a distraction. Every corrupt member of Congress locked in one room and surrounded by real Americans is an opportunity that will never present itself again." And apparently there was a comment right below that post that said, quote, "The final solution is the only solution." Of course, the final solution, a reference to what happened in Nazi Germany.
Yeah, it's when you read it, knowing what we know now, of course, we interpret it very differently. But this is surrounded by, thousands of other posts with similar kinds of insurrectionary fantasy. The way that these people interact online is very much informed by an American history of nationalism, anti-immigrants, that the government now, Adam Sura has a really great piece on this about the coming multiracial democracy. The idea that this is the last time that they are going to be able to do this, that is silly. Congress meets a lot, right? It's not like we're not going to have opportunities in the future for Congress to be, in the Capitol, which is why we have to take this very seriously. But ultimately, it was almost cacophonous, the calls for this type of action.
I'm thinking, too, about President Trump, this quote-unquote charismatic leader, the person who said, only I can fix it, how that's appealing to certain people. Now, the president is not going to say in the next week, I was wrong, the election was free and fair, I apologize, I take this back. I mean, that is not going to happen. But if it were to happen, if that leader were to step up and be honest with the people, in this case, who follow him, would that lower the temperature? Would that help to dial things back?
I cannot know. But I'll tell you what happened when he put out that video the night of the Capitol siege, and online they started picking it apart, saying this must be a deep fake. Look, his lip movements don't match the words that he's saying. This is a script. They're constantly reinterpreting what is happening for what they think is happening. Right. And so online, any of Trump's, if Trump were to come out and say, that the election was free and fair, then the explanation would likely be, well, they're going to put him in jail if he doesn't say that, or which goes back to that. This is not the party of the GOP. This is the party of Trump. And so when we talk about MAGA from this moment forward, we really have to get Republicans to realize that these people are not here for them either. And you can see this in, there was a viral video going around of Lindsey Graham being harassed at the airport. And it was happening because these people believed that Graham had a duty to Trump. And so in the future, as Trump morphs into what happens next, he's most likely going to have no reason to dial it down. And if he tried, I don't think it would be interpreted as, that he was, he finally realized that the election was fair.
I mean, would they turn on him? I mean, if somehow he were to say, oops, I've been lying to you for 5 years.
I mean, I think that
we're speculating here, obviously.
Yeah, I know. But it just I've been through this for years now where all I tell people is it's not deep. There's nothing deep happening here. It's very shallow in terms of the way in which these people have, you know, within the QAnon movement, there's talk of Trump as the God Emperor. This idea that he was chosen by God to do this work. And if you look for instances of that being confirmed, you see it in a lot of places. But I'm most concerned with the people that are in Trump's orbit and in his networks that profited off of this big lie. Rudy Giuliani, Sidney Powell, Lynn Wood, Steve Bannon, Michael Flynn, right? How do we make sure that they're not able to stage further gatherings and continue with this? Because Trump is one part of the network, but you don't get misinformation at scale without a lot of people being enrolled in producing content and circulating it online.
Let me just quickly, I want to pick up on that, quickly reintroduce you. That's Dr. Joan Donovan. She is research director of the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy. That's at the Harvard Kennedy School, where she leads the Technology and Social Change Project. We're talking about last week's assault on the U.S. Capitol, the rhetoric and social media that has really fanned and fueled some of these protests and the activities of this mob. Well, as we know, Twitter has shut down the president's Twitter feed, Facebook, other social media outlets. I believe YouTube has gotten in on the action as well. How do I ask this? So many questions like rattling around in my head. For the followers, are they just going to go sort of deeper into the dark recesses of the internet to be able to espouse their conspiracy theories and paranoid beliefs, or does that sort of shut off some of the oxygen for them?
It's a good question, because we haven't seen a deplatforming of this scale before. Twitter said that it had removed 70,000 accounts. Parler had really been setting itself up, even in its marketing pitches, for this moment. And the move by Amazon Web Services is the one that probably is the most consequential when it comes to the followers, in the sense that they're no longer providing services to Parler, and for Parler to function, it needs very stable infrastructure. And so the reason why we see people who've been deplatformed struggle trying to get back onto YouTube and Twitter and Facebook is because those platforms are incredibly stable, and they provide access to journalists and celebrities and many, many, many more people, orders of magnitude more. But when it comes to this moment, this group is going to have a really hard time reorganizing. I was talking with Ben Collins of NBC the other night, and there were text messages flying around in the QAnon sphere about martial law. It reminded us both very, very much of the pandemic, the early parts of the pandemic, where SMS had started, their text messages had started to replace some of the social media panic. And so we're watching all of these different places, but an app that probably many people haven't heard of, which is Telegram, seems to be the one where not much action has been taken, and these people are starting to organize over there. And that place is particularly troublesome, because it's a place where known white supremacist groups have organized since far before this moment. And I'm cognizant of the fact that they are ready and organized to bring in very scared, very paranoid Trump supporters and further radicalize them.
I mean, the tricky thing, especially in this country with our First Amendment rights, is, you know, people can espouse really dangerous and scary ideas. It's when you act on that, that it, you know, that it violates a law, can we differentiate between the two? Can we say, you know, it's okay to believe QAnon, but it's not okay to act on it?
Yeah. It's hard to say when it comes to,
I feel your pain. No, I think we're all struggling with this.
If not but for, right, is sort of these moments that I've been thinking about related to when we see these groups start to innovate, right? I'm a scholar of the sociology of social movements. We have a few tricks in our bag, a few frameworks that we work with. One of them is about tactical innovation, is when you see groups move from one strategy to another, you have to then start to think, well, especially if you're a platform company, well, right, is my new policy actually going to stop them from innovating again? Or am I going to be in this position where I'm going to be continuously chasing them down? And the half measures that they have been using around these groups for many years, especially the QAnon groups, really do seem to have added capacity to this group to circumvent, more mainstream deplatforming. And I'll give you an example here where we had QAnon groups that were being removed from Facebook for circulating medical misinformation, especially about the vaccine that hadn't even arrived at that point. And when they started to remove those groups, people in the QAnon world decided that they were going to quote unquote go camo. They were going to ditch the letter Q, and they were going to really find a way to seep into other groups on Facebook so that they could stay on the platform. And they ended up in a bunch of these Save the Children groups, child exploitation groups. And that's where we saw a wave of protests around child exploitation in the middle of a pandemic, which was very odd, but it had to do with the evolving capacity of these groups to evade half measures.
And Joan, I do want to pick up on that after this very short break. We're talking with Joan Donovan. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with Dr. Joan Donovan, Research Director of the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy. That's at the Harvard Kennedy School. We're talking about the spread of far-right messages, racist rhetoric, conspiracy theories, and some of the dangers that they pose and what was on display last week in the U.S. Capitol. We're going to talk a bit about how certain people are more vulnerable to radicalization and how to fight the spread of some of these hateful and paranoid beliefs. Picking up on what you said about the QAnon groups talking, sort of associate themselves with these fake Save the Children groups, I was reading about some legitimate groups that do fight child sexploitation running into all sorts of problems because their sites had been infected by some of these QAnon groups with obviously frightening and disastrous results.
Yeah, the results of, the results of this is something that we've really tried to anticipate as a research team. And, as over the years of looking at the groups that associated with the MAGA coalition, they really did feel attacked over the past several years, which has led them into this, it's us or no one kind of situation at the Capitol. But over the years, they've really saw Trump as an embattled president who was being thwarted at every turn to bring about his policy visions. And in doing so, which is, it's a really strange twist to have, a millionaire as a president who's being, touted as someone who's in touch with the working class. And at the same time, I think it goes back to Trump's outsiderness from the get-go, which is that he ran essentially as a Republican that was not of the party. And this is the outcome of that, is that, you know, the years of Republicans kind of bending to Trump's plan and the Trump agenda, as he calls it now, has led us to this moment where I don't think even Republicans can walk it back, because this base has really solidified itself as the party of Trump.
Let me ask you, because this is, you know, this is not the first time there are racist and paranoid groups that are afoot, although they're mostly online in the country. I mean, not so long ago, maybe 100 years ago, the KKK walked openly in the U.S. Capitol. There were the bombing campaigns of the far left, you know, in the 60s, part of the anti-war movement. And thinking about the numbers of arrests from what happened last week, can we arrest our way out of this? If you arrest either the leaders or the followers, does that then begin to shrink and hurt some of these groups, such as they are?
It does, and it's important. And I'll point us to a moment on December 12th where we needed consequences, which was the Proud Boys had stolen Black Lives Matter banners from black churches in D.C. and then burned them, not just as a spectacle amongst each other, but as a spectacle really made for the internet. And those videos circulated widely, not just in the regular press, as you know, or the mainstream press, cable, as look at what these people have done, but also within these alt networks of MAGA supporters. This was cool. And in the midst of looking at the uses of fire, right, by the KKK and the torches and so the torch marches and the cross burnings, it's very ritualistic, and it also shows a kind of vitality that this MAGA movement was really wanting to show. And so if we had had consequences for the Proud Boys in that moment where they're burning the stolen property in the streets, I don't think we get to those people being as organized and as focused on the Capitol as we have. Of course, Enrique Taro, right before, on his way to D.C. or when he arrived in D.C., had been arrested prior to the meetup, but the rest of the Proud Boys had not feared any consequence. Hmm. And when Taro was arrested, I believe it was on Monday before the events on Wednesday, he had two high-capacity magazines on him that were illegal. And so consequences, arresting our way out of this, is going to matter, not just because these people are going to suffer financial losses and be hemmed up on these charges, but also because it the functions of our legal systems in terms of deterrence it's a common consequence, actually, of protests on the left. And so that has to happen here.
Yeah. I was thinking of the Southern Poverty Law Project. One of the things they did was they essentially sued the KKK almost, you know, out of existence. Dominion is suing Trump's lawyer Powell, I think, for something like $1.2 billion for the things, the lies that she told about their voting system. So is that also an effective way to defang some of these groups?
Yeah, I think the Dominion law suit against Powell needs to also extend to other places. And we have to talk seriously, too, about partisan media in this case. When media is designed to further the aims of a party, what places like Newsmax and OANN were doing, One America News Network, was they were repeating the allegations of Powell as if they were reporting on them, but at the same time were really trying to make the case. And so the protections that usually are afforded to the press have also been co-opted and subverted by this movement that is trying to put forward this idea that the Dominion machines were flipping votes and that Trump really had won, but the machines were the problem. And I think that Dominion is right to say that this was will have a very large impact on their business.
I'm wondering too, in the sort of more one-to-one relationship, and I think, you know, we all know people who, you know, have some association with some of these more extremist groups or even, you know, paranoid ideas or QAnon or all of that. How is, as a sort of person to person, how do you convince someone let's say a QAnon supporter, how do you convince them that what they believe in is wrong and that they have been lied to?
This is, you know, a puzzle that I think psychologists are going to have to reckon with, because what we're dealing with is a kind of mass delusion. But for them, it happens because of the way in which our communication infrastructure is set up, in the sense that, you know, just like everybody else, they're avid social media users, they're getting their news, they're looking around for things. And if not for the exploitation of that open communication system by people like Bannon and Giuliani, as well as outlets like the Epoch Times, that were able to create this fully functioning media ecosystem that spread this lie on behalf of Donald Trump, then people don't feel so secure in those ideas. They might stay in the realm of speculation, where I think I heard it on on Facebook, or I saw it on YouTube. However, this is that line that we were talking about earlier, when a belief becomes a cause, which is right, even more difficult to deal with, because then people feel like they have a role to play in changing history. And that's why I think we need much more research on when misinformation mobilizes, when it causes people to do something they wouldn't ordinarily do, like go to the Capitol and try to take it over. But when it comes to the psychology of it, thinking about groups like Hope Not Hate and Life After Hate, de-radicalization is a very one-to-one process.
Right.
And it's a very laborious process. It can take years. It's not going to happen in a conversation. It's not going to happen inch by inch. It's not going to happen, unfortunately, with more facts, because we're dealing with an entire apparatus.
Well, and we're also dealing with how people behave in a crowd. I mean, what we know that crowds empower people. So what you're willing to do when you see other people doing it, you probably would not do if you were, you know, by yourself, if you were all alone.
Yeah, and this is where opportunities make a difference, which is to say that if the National Guard had been deployed and was in the way that I've seen them look in the past, you know, shoulder to shoulder on every row of the Capitol steps, you're not going to get this outcome. And so the under-policing, and as it's being revealed by the Capitol Police Chief and others, there was a strong feeling that optics were really the most important concern. And so they didn't want to look as if they were suppressing this group. They didn't want to look like a strong militarized police force, which is what the Capitol Hill security is like. But I've never heard them worry about that, you know, in relationship to Black Lives Matter. And I'm thinking here specifically about the atrocious optics of the Trump Bible photo op, where they cleared out a crowd in the middle of, you know, in broad daylight, using chemical weapons as well as rubber bullets. Those optics are terrible. But worrying about it related to MAGA, I think, is an effect of sympathy with the president. Obviously, the whiteness of the protesters plays a role, and the fact that I'm hoping there will be a full investigation into any of the back and forth conversation that that produced this moment.
Absolutely. I want to pick up on something you said earlier about facts, because we try to deal with, you know, truth as close as we can get to it and facts. So in today's environment where it does sometimes feel as if what is factual is a lie, what is lie is factual, how do we detangle that, or can we?
Yeah, I've been a big proponent of creating pathways online for timely, local, relevant, and accurate information. And this has come about especially in relationship to the pandemic, where it is life and death if people encounter misinformation, because that shapes their health behaviors, especially the debates about masks, where people think that not just that masks are unhelpful, but also that masks have the potential to hurt you in some way. That kind of thinking, when it circulates online, can have a really detrimental effect. So I wrote a piece for Scientific American a few months ago about truth advocacy and how we do need advocates for the truth, but we also need platform companies to look at the dynamics by which information is amplified and reorder things so that virality isn't the most important feature, but rather that information quality, especially accurate information, can be seen and circulated online so that people have it on the ready in their timelines and feeds and in their recommendations. But unfortunately, as we all know, the truth is very boring. It's not scandalous. It's not salacious. You know, there's not a lot of palace intrigue. And so we need to clearly mark that online. Reddit has done a remarkable job over the years of figuring out how to mark information, how to root out conspiracy, how to dampen threats and harassment. And so I think it's really important that we think about where we don't see this happening and why their human scale moderation policies are a much better and much more healthy way to go about our, you know, the future of information online.
We're about a minute before we have to say goodbye. So do you see this as a fixable problem, but one that can also preserve the diversity of ideas that is so important to a democracy?
It's fixable if we think about where we need to make our interventions. One thing that is routinely exploited by disinformers is the openness of platforms. And we see this even with the junk science that's being circulated about COVID and whatnot. And so we need to think about openness, and we need to think about investing in content curation and moderation strategies that are accomplishable by employing more humans in the loop. The second thing we have to realize is I joke with my team about Donovan's law of disinformation, but you know, it's basically this idea that if you leave disinformation to fester, it will infect the whole product. And so we do need policies within these companies that deal with that very early on.
Well, I really appreciate you giving us an hour today on Radio Times. Joan Donovan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And she is research director of the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, where she leads the Technology and Social Change Project. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. And you can always get a podcast of the show wherever you find your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowain. Thank you so much for joining us.